Welcome to Talking Supply Chain. In each episode, you'll hear from the authors that make Supply Chain Management Review such a special publication. This podcast is hosted by Bob Troublecock, Editorial Director of Supply Chain Management Review. Remember that Bob welcomes your comments now to today's episode. Welcome to today's episode of Talking Supply Chain, the best laid plans or how to improve your demand planning. I'm Bob Troublecock, and joining me today is Jonathan Carlson, the CEO of the consulting firm Northfind Management. Jonathan, welcome.
Thanks, Bob. Happy to be here.
Great. We're happy to have you. We've all heard the saying about how the best laid plans often go awry. That's certainly true of most organizations' demand planning. But why is demand planning so often off the mark? And is there anything we can do to improve its performance? Those are questions that today's guest has written about in a great white paper focused on improving demand planning performance through the reduction of human bias. And at the end of this podcast, I'll give you the URL to Northfind Management so you can look it up if you're interested in reading Jonathan's white paper. So Jonathan, I found the white paper really fascinating, especially the idea that human bias impacts supply chain outcomes. We're not going to have time to go into deep detail here, but why don't we start by explaining why, from your experience, demand planning goes awry, and then talk a little bit about the role that all of us have biases, the role that biases play in demand planning.
Sure. Well, the question of why demand planning goes awry is sounds tantalizingly simple, but it's actually pretty complex. And there's two parts to the answer to that question, both of which contain some of the conversation that we're going to be having around bias. On the first part, demand plans are difficult to get right because, unlike what the neoclassical economists thought for the last 300 years, humans are not perfectly rational creatures or people. We used to believe in neoclassical economics that when you provide clear value-based choices to people, they're going to naturally choose the one that has the greatest utility or value to them. And on that basis, it makes planning a lot easier. But the reality is, to use Dan Ariely's words, humans are actually predictably irrational. So even if we had a very well-created forecast or demand planning process, the problem is we're trying to account for the behaviors of people who themselves are not highly predictable. So that's challenge number one. Challenge number two is, even once we've got a handle on some of that predictable irrationality, within our planning processes themselves, there exist a host of unconscious biases and heuristics that threaten demand planning performance. And this is even within the statistical part of the planning process. I can jump into that further now if you want, or you might have a follow-on question before I get too far down the rabbit hole on biases and heuristics.
I'm all for rabbit holes, but for a moment, what struck me as you were just talking, and again thinking about this idea of bias, I'm editing the next issue of Supply Chain Management Review, and I'm running a story on a Canadian auto parts company that you're probably familiar with, which is Princess Auto.
Yeah, for sure.
And it was how they redid their planning and inventory management process, particularly in predicting, you know, inventory levels at the shelf. And one of the things they talked about, now they focused in this article about how to overcome, you know, the resistance to change. And they talked about, you know, meeting with one planner as they were putting in this new process, who looked at suggested inventory shelf levels for a particular SKU. And he said, well, this can't possibly be right. This would never sell like that at that store. And hence the sort of bias, yeah, right? Based on what I think, that could never happen. And when they had a second meeting and he had his whole team there, he said, You know, I'd like to hear what you think about some of these other SKUs, because when I went back and looked, this particular SKU is performing exactly as you predicted. Yeah. And so it was kind of interesting that based on what he thought was his experience and what he thought he knew, he couldn't look at the data and accept it. And then he went back and realized that, I guess, because of bias, you know, that he was wrong. And I guess that was one of the things that taught him to trust the system.
Yeah. So there's a couple of biases at play there in your example, Bob. One is, and they're both toxic to demand planning. The first is one that most people have heard of, which is overconfidence. And the second is confirmation bias. And interestingly, when Daniel Kahneman, who ultimately won the Nobel Prize in 2002 for his work in behavioral economics, began applying his psychology background into problem solving very early in his career, he encountered a situation much like what you're describing. He was asked to improve the predictive capability of a group of experts. I'm putting quotes around experts, who up until that point had been conducting the interviews for the Israeli Defense Force. So when an incoming would-be soldier is coming to them, they're interviewing and then based on their judgment, making a recommendation as to whether or not they're going to make a good soldier. The reason he was called in is because they were horrible at actually being able to predict the future performance of these soldiers. So he broke it down to a data-based discussion and had some very, very basic criteria that he thought would predict good soldiers. And their response was just like your demand planner's response. Like, this can't possibly work. I'm an expert. I've been doing this for a long time. I know what's going to work. So what he did to overcome some of that overconfidence as well as confirmation bias is recognize, you know, what's the driver of this demand planner taking that position? He or she, like all of us, want to feel useful in our job. And we don't like the idea that some new process or tool, if it's AI, might expose that we haven't been as good as we or other people have thought we have been. So he actually asked these experts at the end of the new rubric that he pulled together to then close their eyes and imagine, based on the interview that they'd now had based on his rubric, whether or not the interviewee would make a good soldier. And what he found was, once they'd gone through the rubric that he derived based on much better data-based predictors of future performance, their judgments then became very, very good. And what had happened was he'd inadvertently primed them to be using much more sort of data and rational-based judgment rather than gut and intuition. And gut and intuition is what, in many of these cases, what ultimately leads us astray. I'm happy in the case of your example for Princess Auto that this demand planner ultimately saw the value of the data-based prediction that they were using and got on board, because it doesn't have to be binary. It's a way for us to be better, and we can still add the benefit of human judgment that AI and technology and statistics never will be able to replace.
Before I jump to some of the suggestions, when you were just talking there and when I was thinking about, again, the Princess Auto article, it made me wonder, you know, we tend to think of the person who goes by their gut, the person who's set in their ways as the, I'm going to use the term grizzled veteran, yep. Right? The person that's been doing this forever and says, you know, I don't need a tool, you know, I've got experience, I've done that. But does bias play across the age groups? I mean, do we find, might be different biases, but biases that can affect the plan in, you know, younger, less experienced planners as well? Does it cut across experiences, you know, or experience levels?
Like I said at the outset, there's a host of biases. And I mean, they belong to a much smaller subgroup of categories. So something like overconfidence has a bunch of different ways it can be manifested. But overconfidence is a great example which does cut across age groups. But interestingly, after some of the original overconfidence research had been done, a couple of researchers named Dunning and Kruger discovered that there's actually an inverse correlation between experience and overconfidence. In other words, the less experience a person has, the more likely they are to overestimate their predictive capabilities. So we see it in grizzled veterans, but we're less likely to see overconfidence in grizzled veterans because they've been burned enough times to know they don't know everything. But other biases, like a bunch of manifestations of the representativeness bias, which includes things like illusory correlation, where we believe two sets of data are correlated, but they're not, or the cluster illusion effect, where we're looking at stochastic data or random data, and we think we see patterns. In research that we've done and others have done, we saw this cut across all age groups. It doesn't matter if the person's got 20 plus years or a year. Unless people are actively measuring their propensity to have these biases, they're merrily going about their demand planning way, finding patterns that don't exist and adding unconscious biases to the process. And there's many more, but suffice to say, even grizzled veterans are not immune to the effects of unconscious biases.
I want to throw a curveball question at you, which is this. To the audience, before we jumped on here, Jonathan said, it sounds like you've actually read my white paper, which I had. And there's a lot there, which is reason, again, I'm going to suggest that you look it up, and I'll give you the URL at the end. But one of the things I wondered is, it's not a usual topic for supply chain you know, when we're thinking about supply chain, we think about efficiencies and KPIs and whatever, and bias isn't a usual usual topic. How did you get started on this? You know, what led to the research that you and your firm have done?
Sure. Well, in demand planning, mathematical bias is one of the typical performance metrics that you look at when you're looking at forecasting. The first and most obvious is forecast accuracy. But then from there, when we want to look if we've got a directional proclivity towards error, so in other words, do we tend to overestimate or underestimate, we look at bias. And a third very effective metric is forecast value add, which looks at what elements of the forecast are making me better or worse. And it's really in the work we were doing previously, trying to understand how to improve forecasting performance in various different types of supply chains, and getting into forecast value add, that we got beyond the question, how accurate am I and how biased am I mathematically, to ask the more important question, why? So it's interesting to see that I've got a positive delta on my forecast accuracy month on month, or my bias is getting better. But if I don't understand why, I can't take corrective action. So as we begin to unpack that question, where are these? How biased am I, and why is my bias what it is? And how much of the overall bias in my forecast is being generated by the statistical tool itself versus the inputs I'm getting from sales versus the inputs I'm getting from customers themselves? When we get that granular, now we can start to ask more probing questions like, well, I'm not typically seeing bias being generated by my statistical baseline. Where I get my bias and forecast is typically coming from some of the stakeholders. And I know that in the case of sales, it's X percent. And in the case of my customers, it's Y percent. And at the superficial level, we can surmise, well, in the case of sales, they're overestimating because that's what sales does. They're optimistic. We want them to be optimistic. Maybe more cynically, we might think in some cases that they're overestimating to ensure they've got the product for their customers. This is kind of a typical supply chain view of things. But we wanted to go a level deeper and understand, listen, beyond the superficial reasons that people might be gaming the system, are there other reasons that they're unaware of that they're carrying biases in the demand planning process? So we did some work with Harvard Business School professors Francesca Gino and visiting professor John Bashirs into behavioral economics. and started to really understand, how do we detect some of these biases? Where do these biases come from? There's even evolutionary reasons for the biases. The way that our brains process information leads itself to us being much more reactive than taking the time to step back and be more judgmental and critical and objective. Kind of a longish answer to your question, but essentially we got into behavioral economics and demand planning for the same reason that we do a lot of our work, which is it's interesting to understand the what, but it's much more interesting to understand the why. And it was understanding the why of forecast errors that really led us this way.
Great. Thank you for that. So as I mentioned at the start, and again, there's a lot here to unpack in this article. So I'm going to jump to the end because you had four, I think, important takeaways to readers in terms of how they can reduce bias to improve their demand planning. So the first was, don't use what you don't measure. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, I'm not going to take credit for that one. That's Peter Drucker. Or a paraphrase anyway, he said, if you can't fix what you don't measure. What we see too often in a lot of organizations is our forecast inputs being used that are intuitively appropriate. What I mean by that is it makes sense intuitively that our customers would probably know better than us what they need. So we take their inputs and we roll them into the forecast and we don't check what the benefit of those inputs are, and then our forecast accuracy is what it is, and we assume we're doing something wrong. And we've seen time and time again in organizations where they're taking forecasts from customers without checking the error of these forecasts and just blindly letting them drive production requirements. And that's just one example. I would apply this equally across any input in the forecasting process. It's crazy to drive a signal to your production environment from signals that you haven't tested the accuracy of. So don't use what you don't measure is all about, well, it's going to be interesting in the postmortem to look at what the bias and accuracy is and do what we can to fix it. But let's actually see what we can do to filter some of that out at the top of the funnel. And if some of these signals are consistently biased, let's not include them in the forecast.
The second takeaway was show your bias. So talk us through that.
Yeah, so this is sort of like a subset of the first idea. You can't fix what you don't measure. So if you're not measuring what your bias is, you're not able to fix it. And showing your bias means literally that. We need to be measuring the bias of every step of the process and every component of the process. If you've got multiple demand planners, we need to be looking at what individually the effect of their inputs or modifications to a forecast is having. Is it making it better? If so, why? And let's do more of that. Is it not? Let's understand what the thought process or rationale is there and try to correct that. But the idea that a lot of organizations want to shy away from really granular forecast accuracy and bias metrics because it might show something that doesn't look nice, to me is also crazy. It's still happening, even if you're not measuring it. The benefit of measuring it is now you can see it, and now you've got a clear line of sight to the opportunity to fix it. So measuring is really, really key at every step of the forecasting process.
The third, which sounds like good advice for anybody, whatever you're doing, but applying it to demand planning, never stop learning.
Yeah. The state of the art or the best practice in demand planning is not static. In the 1950s, the idea of computer-based forecasting was out of reach for all but the largest organizations or government agencies. Now it's commonplace. Now a lot of people are talking about AI and machine learning, and it's becoming so accessible that a lot of people, I would argue a lot of people who shouldn't be using it are also using it. And what we mean by this is never stop being curious, not only in terms of what more could be done to improve the process. And here again is where I think behavioral economics holds a lot of opportunity because it doesn't have the cost or complexity of solutions like AI or machine learning. But in addition, it also means never stop learning about one's process itself. So never stop trying to get even more granular into the causes of and sources of bias and error in the forecasting process.
Before I ask you about the fourth little bullet, I just want to touch on something, because I'm going to go back to the Princess Auto story, which in terms of revamping their processes, Princess Auto did bring in some new technology tools. But instead of the, you know, it's 70% technology, 30% people, they sort of flipped that on their head, where it was 70 or 80% people and 20% technology. I've got another article in the same issue from a former executive at Merck talking about the same thing, that Merck approached their S&OP process as a people first, and then technology came in. And everything we're talking about here, even though there are these great technology tools like AI and machine learning and demand planning, seems to be, you know, like the low-hanging fruit where people are starting, you're really focusing on people here, correct?
In this process, sure. I mean, I want to be clear, because we also tell clients or prospective clients something similar. We have a pyramid of enablement for S&OP or IBP, which is 10% tools, 30% people, and 60% culture. Sorry, 30% process and 60% culture. And a lot of technology companies take exception to that. So I want to be really clear, first of all, that although today we're talking about behavioral economics, that technology piece is one of the three necessary enablers of success. Even if the proportion of differentiation, and I'll explain what I mean in a moment, is much less than process or culture, it's still absolutely necessary. What I mean by 10% technology is the gap between best of breed in technology and not great in technology isn't nearly as substantial a predictor of future performance in S&OP or IBP as the difference in a great culture or a bad culture. So getting technology right is important, but it's like 10% of the battle. Getting culture right, or getting the people part of the equation right, is absolutely what's going to drive success. The process piece, the reason we call that 30% is, again, it's necessary to have the right process defined, but S&OP has been around for 40 plus years. There's so little differentiating between the best possible interpretation of it and a mediocre interpretation that it alone is not going to be the determinant of success either. So in short, I absolutely agree with Princess Auto. You need technology. If you're an enterprise of any kind of a scale beyond a lemonade stand, there's no getting around the fact that you're going to need technology to leverage your data. But it's really going to be how engaged and bought in and effective are your people at using that technology and process that determines whether or not you're going to be successful. And that's what BE is all about. And that's why I think it's so exciting.
Great. Last question from your four, and I think this is definitely a people question as well. You suggest that we value diversity. Diversity is much in the news right now. So when you think of it from a planning standpoint or a team standpoint, you know, what's diversity and what do we value?
Yeah. So for the benefit of people who haven't read the white paper in its entirety, like you, this was almost like a necessary disclaimer that I put into the four takeaways, because part of the research we did, and this was initial research we did with Heineken, looking at 176 of their global demand planners, and then afterwards Dell Technologies. Both these organizations were interested in understanding what level of biases exist in the various parts of their demand planning teams. But they also wanted, like Daniel Kahneman initially did, to understand what predictors could we use to help us select the right demand planners right from the start. So they wanted to understand, are there correlations between certain personality types and the prevalence of certain biases? And the result of the research we did was absolutely yes. No one's immune to bias, but there are absolutely certain personality types that are more prone to the kind of biases that will impact forecasting than others. And I'm not going to give any spoilers to encourage people to go and read the white paper. But what I also want to be really careful to point out is there are a lot of biases that themselves stem from a kind of homogeneity of thought, or when you have all the same type of people sitting around the table, on the one hand, you can make decisions really quickly, and it's going to feel like you're an effective decision-making organization because they're happening so quickly. But in times of crisis, you really need some of those diverging opinions. A great example of this is the Challenger crisis the Challenger disaster in the 80s. A lot of NASA's scientists and a lot of their third-party engineers had very, very similar backgrounds, very similar thought processes, and as a result, missed some fairly obvious gaps in data because they all thought about things the same way. So what we're saying here is, yes, there are certain personality types that are probably more prone to forecasting bias than others. However, there's also a corresponding benefit to having different types of background and thought processes to challenge assumptions and to avoid the type of groupthink that can lead to bad outcomes as well. So you need to balance the two.
Thanks. So to the attendees, if you want to read the full white paper, you can go to NorthFind's website. It's www.north-find.com or north-find.com. And I'm sure you can find it there. It really is a good read. I found it really thought-provoking. It's one of the reasons I wanted to have Jonathan on today. That's all the time we have. So again, let's thank Jonathan Carlsa for joining me today. And thank you for listening. I hope you'll be back for our next episode. For Supply Chain Management Review, I'm Bob Troublecock. Talking Supply Chain is produced by Supply Chain Management Review and Peerless Media. You can find it on scmr.com, on iTunes, or under SC247, or just Google SC247 podcasts. For more information, be sure to visit scmr.com. We hope you'll join us again.